of Kona, Hawaii, Big Eye, Big Island, here in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, planet Ocean, as we rotate around our solar beautiful star, rotating in this galaxy, on and on and on into infinity. We're on the event horizon with Nassim Harriman today. We're going to be stretching our minds out to the macrocosm and then shrinking it down to the microcosm to see how we stand somewhere in between those two event horizons. And we form what we're calling human consciousness and reality. Won't that be fun? Well, welcome back, Nassim, to our show.
Thank you. I want to let
everybody know that we're being brought to you today by photon.net. It's an easy internet. You can get on the internet with photon.net. 28,000 local dial-ups across the United States. And Randy Barris and his team at Photon have been bringing us these radio programs for now these last couple of months. Really appreciate that. While you were coming in, you were hearing the music of Kathy Safada. And for those of us on the local horizon, Kathy is a musician who's coming to us from Mount Shasta. She'll be giving us a program of her entertainment this weekend, Friday the 13th. No, don't be afraid of that, folks. It's actually going to be an expansive Friday right here at the Skea around 7:30. I'd encourage everybody who's here on the Big Island to check her out. Beautiful, beautiful music, sonic vibrations. As I was mentioning, Photon is bringing us this program, and Photon's been getting a lot of in the news lately. They have just been given the go-ahead to broadcast live this weekend's Global Sacred Geometry Conference in Sedona, Arizona. That's February 12th, 13th, 14th, and 15th. You'll be able to listen to such speakers as Drumvalo Melchizedek and Patrick Flanagan, as well as Slim Sperling, all of which who've got some fascinating sacred geometric theories and ideas that they're putting out to the world at large, really have shifted our consciousness over the last 10 or 15 years with their thinking. And I would encourage all of you who are interested in that topic, go ahead and check out. If you can't get it to Sedona, it will be broadcast live on photon.net, so look for that information. Well, here at dolphinville.com, we are a membership that's for free, and we're trying to encourage people who believe that dolphins and whales offer another level of consciousness to humans. In fact, they probably represent a level of intelligence, an alien intelligence to us, the best example that we could possibly imagine right here on planet Earth. Dolphinville has been dedicated to people who kind of look at dolphins and whales as another sentient species and have stopped our inner chatter long enough to start listening to the messages that come up from the deep inside. We've had some extraordinary experiences here as the whales have come into their yearly sojourn down to return to their birthplace. They've been sharing their beautiful bodies, huge information waves. In fact, they've been swimming close to shore. There was an incident just recently where just off the shore, some people were out having a regular shore swim, and suddenly a group of whales came in to exchange ideas and looks with them. Nassim, you were part of that exchange, weren't you?
I was. It was just so amazing to be in the presence of those animals and to have them like come right up to you and show their willingness to swim with you and interact and, you know, exchange energies, if you could like. And being in the energy of these mammals is really something that you can't really describe. It's like the water texture feels different. The sounds of the water feels different. Everything seems to like slow down to like, everything, it seems to be in slow motion or something. It's really interesting.
We hear about charged water or clustered water that are being talked about. I believe that in the presence of whales, and certainly to dolphins to some extent, but whales being so immense, they put up a vibrational frequency that alters the molecular structure of the whale of the water around them.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. And, you know, I'd like to study a little bit more of what's going on in the ultrasonic level of transmission that occurs when these encounters occur, because I think there's a lot of information that's occurring at the ultrasonic level that we're not aware of. And so I was devising, actually I was spending some time with Patrick Flanagan at one time, and we were playing with a device that downsteps the ultrasound into audio range so that you can hear it. So you got a little headphones on your head, and you got a little box, and it picks up the ultrasound, and you can hear what's out there in terms of ultrasounds. And we were quite amazed about how much ultrasound is going on around us and how much ultrasound we produce ourselves, and how focused these ultrasounds are. For instance, if you do a ohm, we tested where we did a ohm at like almost 50 yards away from each other, and so one had the device and the other one was 50 yards away and homing in a very quiet way, you know, like a really quiet ohm, and you could hear the person ohming out of the ultrasound range, mm-hmm. like if they were right beside you. And as soon as they turned their head away from the device, you would lose the signal. So that means that it was quite directional, and we pinpointed it down to the area of the sinus cavity between the in the third eye, really. And it seems to be a very focused field. So there's all sorts of things going on in the ultrasound level that we're actually hypothesizing that these, you know, that even telepathic communication might be an effect of ultrasound itself, and that it might not be so, you know, woo-woo, and that it might be actually quite mappable in the ultrasound, you know, supersonic range.
Well, now, Sim, you're known as a hyperdimensional physicist, mm-hmm. and, of course, most people go, well, what is that? Some of what we're talking about right now, ultrasound, for example, mm-hmm. is below the normal spectrum of measurements, mm-hmm. and yet it's occurring, just like hyperdimensional physics is mm-hmm. a study of what's occurring at subatomic or macro levels mm-hmm. that are beyond the normal range of what we think about.
Yeah, ultrasounds are in the range of measurements, but they're not in the range of audible measurements. And so, yeah, just like ultrasounds or even radio waves, you know, radio waves are going around all the time. Until you turn your radio on, you don't hear them or you don't feel them in general. And so, you know, the same thing can be taught about, you know, the space-time and dimensions out there that are going on that are not necessarily directly experienced by our five senses, and so we have a tendency to think they're not there. And it really is starting to come to the attention of the physics and world community that actually there is a lot of activity out there that's going on that is actually may be actually the cause of the activity that we do observe, meaning that the activity we observe, what we see as reality, is really kind of a side effect of what's going on in higher dimensions or at different levels of perception. Mm. And that becomes very interesting. It's similar to the change that happened when we thought that the electromagnetic spectrum that's visible was the only possible frequencies of light. And then, you know, Maxwell wrote the equations, and by error, you know, in laboratories, they eventually found X-ray and infrared and all this, and they realized, oh, yeah, there is frequencies that are not necessarily directly, you know, experienced, but they are still there and they're quite usable. Mm-hmm. Well, we're starting to understand that there is dimensional systems that are there, and we're starting to figure out how we could start to use those.
Yeah. And we're looking at information on a molecular level, mm-hmm. subatomic level, information that can be read, interpreted, mm-hmm. and actually change the way we think about the things around us, which is really the function of information.
Yeah, and philosophically as well, it brings us to, you know, an awareness of our surrounding that is quite different from the, you know, average awareness, meaning that if you now know that there is all this activity in your vicinity and you if you concentrate on it, you can become aware of it or aware of, partially aware of it, then, you know, you might start to interact with the world in a completely different way. And I think that's very, very powerful, very useful. So in that sense, the physics is reaching conclusions that are very common to the spiritual thoughts. And in that way, really the physics and the spiritual thoughts starts to mesh and come together and give us a whole picture of the dynamics that are going on.
Well, your work over the last 10 or 15 years specifically has been working towards publishing scientific papers that will describe a united view of physics, biology, chemistry, and consciousness in general.
Mm-hmm. All at once.
Yeah. So it is, as we mentioned last week, and for those of you who weren't tuned in last week, we had a fascinating opportunity to interview Nassim with the scientist Dr. Elizabeth Rauscher. The two of them have developed a model, shall we say, a mathematical model for the universe, which is an extension, another level, a tier of thinking to Einstein's field equations. The result could be very profound, describing the origin of spin angular momentums in the universe. And this describes the foundation of reality, which emerges from rotation and is centered by a stillness or singularity. Mm-hmm. Now, this all sounds like another language, perhaps, but these are the kinds of things that really affect consciousness on a very refined level.
Yes, because, you know, from any theories that had a certain level of accuracy came out very, very practical applications and very deep philosophies, you know. And, you know, for instance, from Einstein realizing that they might not just be one time to the whole universe, but that each frame of reference is dealing with its own perception of time, you know, you can easily extrapolate that to, you know, the way consciousness works, what is the role of consciousness and so on in the universe. And so basically, you know, a new level of ideas, if it's accurate, and if the math works, and so far the math are beautiful and they work impeccably. I'm not sure how you say that. Sorry for my English. I lose it at times. So the work is going very well and it's looking very good. And from that base, a whole new set of information of how we interact with the universe, what it means in the universe that we are, you know, here, and how, you know, the universe responds to our presence comes to bear, you know. And like you said, you know, the way we saw that, the way we are, you know, mapping that out is that we're showing that actually space-time has torsion in it, that it has spin, that it has, you know, the fundamental dynamics from which all of reality emerge from, meaning that if something does not spin, if something does not rotate, it does not radiate energy, and if it doesn't, then it is not available for our five senses to detect. And so it becomes, you know, or even, you know, our instrumentation to detect. It has to have some kind of energy radiation level for us to be able to see it. And so what we're saying here is that we're now showing that we can pinpoint the cause of rotation, the cause of angular momentum, the cause of why everything spins, and as a result, everything becomes what we call real or reality or radiates, you know, in a way that we can detect it. And so that is very profound.
At the core of this, instead of chaos theory, we have order theory.
That's right.
And so this makes us feel differently about ourselves. If we've been given, science has given us the most advanced thinking as being there is nothing but chaos, mm-hmm. then you're flipping that around and saying, yes, at the very core of everything is the supreme order, which you've been able to demonstrate over and over again with mm-hmm. some of your theories. We talk about sacred geometry, and I think that's a great, great tool. You talk about spins and No, there's a lot of information about consciousness and how we're able to take focused intention and actually create energy vibrations and energy spins.
Mm-hmm.
One of the techniques that have been reestablished, an ancient technique called the Merkaba meditations, which has somebody in a deep state of meditation focusing on the Star of David and rotating the two tetrahedrons within the sphere of consciousness
mm-hmm.
in opposite directions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is kind of... okay, well, Randy, who is an expert in this, is telling me from his operator's thing that the spins are going in the same direction. Okay, well, one way I understood it was that one tetrahedron is spinning in one direction and the other tetrahedron is spinning in the opposite direction
yeah.
towards the speed of light, creating a certain condition.
Yes.
That condition seems to reflect the same kind of theory that you're talking about.
Yes.
Spin dynamics.
Spin dynamics, absolutely. I think that, you know, the geometry, first of all, I don't usually use the term sacred geometry. The reason why is because I believe the universe is geometric in nature. That, like, everything you see in nature is based on a specific geometry that's, you know, being extrapolated through a fractal system. And so I think that, you know, if you separate geometry with sacred geometry, then there's got to be some geometry out there that's not sacred. And I don't really agree with that polarized view. I think that all geometry is sacred. So, you know, there's no separation. However, there's definitely, I think, the root of the concepts of sacred geometry is that there is a fundamental logos. There is a fundamental geometry from which all other dynamics arises. And, you know, in physics, that type of geometry is described in group theory. And I use group theory in solving Einstein field equations to show that actually at the atomic level, there's a direct link between the torsion field of space-time and subatomic particles. Now, that's getting a little technical. But what I'm meaning is that there is geometry involved there, very specific crystallographic groups, which are geometric groups. And these geometry basically describe how atoms and subatomic particles come together, how their forces interact, and how the universe is constructed out of them. So it's very fundamental and it's very crucial. The thing is in general, in physics, the geometry is overlooked. Although the groups are used and the geometry is used, it's not considered to be, the geometry itself is not looked upon as something that is really happening in space.
Mm-hmm.
In this view, we're showing that the space itself, that the vacuum of space, is actually structured in the base of those geometry, and that's why these geometries are so good mathematically to describe all of reality. Now, the concepts that these geometry are rotated in a meditation, adventure, you know, through space, is interesting. I don't necessarily agree with it. What I don't agree with is that from my experience, and that's only from my experience, I started meditating when I was 11, and meditation was a way for me in what I understand of it to still the mind and go into into a point of stillness, what I call singularity, and that within that point of stillness, all spins become possible. For instance, I'll give you a technical example of it a little more. I just made the statement earlier that space-time is what's spinning everything because space-time has torsion in it. Now, we've proven this mathematically now, and we're just about to publish it by modifying Einstein's field equations. Now, however, you could say, well, what's putting distortion in space-time itself? You know, are you just not kind of backing up one more step to trying to explain spin? You know, you're not necessarily giving the cause. And the cause is, the way we express it in this theory, is the difference in density between different states of vacuum. Meaning, for instance, the vacuum in our solar system is much more dense than the vacuum inside the galaxy, right? And then inside the galaxy is much more dense than in between galaxies, which is the largest vacuum that we've been able to observe. But even in a very, you know, high level of vacuum, for instance, between galaxies, the molecules are still only centimeters apart, right? It's quite full of material still. And, you know, imagine you've got molecules that are more apart and molecules that more dense, right? Like high pressure of hot air and low pressure of cold air meeting. Well, when they meet, they create torsion, they create rotation, because they try to reach equilibrium. And as they do, the center equilibrium point of the hurricane or the tornado that it generates is stillness, the eye of the hurricane. And when we meditate, really we're trying to approach that point of stillness, as far as my understanding is. And so I am assuming that the spin is occurring in those geometries on their own. And that's where I don't necessarily agree that it's, you know, to go and try to impose our will on these spins might not be the correct approach, more than going to the point of stillness and sinking deeper and deeper into that difference in pressure, that differential. And deeper we go into that stillness, faster the spin, faster the energy level, faster the more radiance is occurring. And so, I mean, I'm talking esoterically here, but I actually have equations for that. I have equations that are balance equations between the collapsing space-time curvature spinning towards singularity and the radiating electromagnetic field radiating from that singularity. Just like as water goes down the drain, air comes out, you know, the two are a balance equation. And so deeper we go into the singularity, more radiance. And deeper we go into the stillness, more spin. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I would say on that.
So that the universe being a balance system that goes towards ordering itself. And you're suggesting that as we meditate or as we gather this point of stillness, then all the energy would become even more and more available to us.
That's right.
Now, you talk about geometric systems. I was recalling the periodic table from high school chemistry, mm-hmm. which demonstrates how the very elements fit together mm-hmm. in a geometric form.
That's right.
They don't seem, you know, they chemically try to describe how they all spherically join, and as they become more and more complex systems, then the elements themselves change, all based on very simple principles
mm-hmm.
that our good old friend Bucky Fuller changed into architecture and ways of looking at the maps of the universe.
That's right. And when you say the universe always go towards further order, that seems to violate the laws of thermodynamics, the laws of physics that are like called the natural laws that are fundamental to our current physics. However, if you look at nature, you will find that there is very high levels of organization that are occurring, and that actually further we go in time, meaning longer we are away from the Big Bang, the initial moment,
mm-hmm.
More complex the systems got and not more disorganized. And so, you know, there's something that happened with chaos theory. I mean, chaos theory is actually a theory that says that there's not really any true chaos, that there's just different level of orders. And I can give you an example about that. Like, if you have a beautiful Persian rug, and you have your nose in it, like you're so close to it that your nose is touching it, you might look at all the grains of, you know, of threads of of material and the colors and think that they're completely random because you're too close. But as you pull back from the rug, slowly you start to see patterns and you start to see the order that generates the beautiful Persian rug. And I think that this is an analogy a little bit to the way we've been looking at things.
Perspective,
exactly. And all the laws of thermodynamics that we have that says that things always go towards further disorder, mm-hmm. all start with this very simple phrase that's constantly overlooked. And it says, within the confine of a closed system, da 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 da. Now, if you look up closed system in any physics books, you will see the description says that no such thing has ever been found. So all of our laws of physics, our natural laws, are based on something that is not found. Now, that is not found in nature, that is.
Euclidean geometry doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. And so that is a fundamental problem. But how do you solve it? Because if you don't have a closed system, how do you measure anything from anywhere? You know, you can't do any physics, you can't do any. Well, the key, that's where the key comes in of the fractal geometry, because the fractal gives you that opportunity to have both a closed system and an open system at the same time.
Well, this is something I do want to get into because I think it's the core of your work, and I've listened to you describe this a number of ways. You've given some great, great models for giving analogy of how that works, but it is the very, very essence of some of the things that you're bringing forward. And as Einstein brought forward theories 100 years ago, almost exactly, and it did affect all of society and culture, whether it was directly or indirectly, we saw new forms of art being born out of cubism to non-objective art forms. We saw new forms of music coming out of composers' heads. And maybe, as we were talking about earlier, that as one person pushes their expanded consciousness to another realm of perception, then other perceptive beings also begin to see the new enlightened horizons, the new event horizons.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, if you look at what Einstein brought to the field, you know, what he brought to the table was a geometrization of space-time. And, you know, so it had to do with structure and the way structures interact. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's along the same lines. You know, we're just going to the next level of the geometry of space-time and defining it more clearly. And as we define it more clearly, it changes our optics on the way the universe functions and the way we live in it. And that's very important.
Well, it's our connection to what consciousness is and how it is expanding and accelerating with our new views and how we're going to apply it. So we'll get back in about a minute and a half. I want you to listen to a little bit more of Kathy Safada, as I mentioned earlier, someone who's coming here locally at the end of the week. And we'll be back in a few and discuss more about the nature of the singularity.
Rejoice, dance and sing, celebrate everything. Rejoice, dance and sing, celebrate everything. Glory, hallelujah.
about the very center of our being, our center of our consciousness. We're doing it from a place that is the center of the Pacific Ocean, the largest geographic feature on planet Ocean. This is a very special place here. All of us who've come to live here have felt some kind of a calling. Many of us, from Dolphinville anyway, have felt a calling from the cetaceans, the dolphins and the whales, that have brought us into a new way of thinking about ourselves, a new way of thinking about ourselves in relationship to the planet. It's great to be able to share as neighbors. Having Nassim is my next-door neighbor. I look out my window, and there he is, and we're both looking down at what is a sacred bay to the Hawaiians and has, as an added bonus, a rather unique sacred geometric point of reference, a latitude that is 19.47 degrees on planet Earth. It is something that is where a tetrahedron would be divided, its base of the tetrahedron within a sphere. Why is that significant? Well, I think as we've talked about sacred geometries and the Merkaba and how that is a sacred model, perhaps of consciousness as we know it, and maybe the evolving consciousness that possibly is moving to another form of itself, a dodecahedron, as some people have described, a new model of our conscious being. But anyway, here we are, neighbors at 19.47 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Nassim, you're theorizing new ways of mathematically modeling consciousness and how we can look at it as a fixed system of math, mm-hmm. a model that can be referred to as a system of infinity that is represented by mathematical formulation, a replicating, self-replicating system, which really would be the same system that we're trying to describe consciousness.
That's right. Really, the way, basically, I'm attempting to map the way creation occurs, which leads directly to the concepts of consciousness. You know, just like physics, in general, is attempting to map the dynamics of consciousness. Of creation, of reality.
Nature of existence.
That's right. Eventually, you have to get to the point where you go, okay, well, how does consciousness fit in this? What is its role? Where does it emerge? And why does it emerge? And what is its relationship to all the other forces? And really, my path has brought me to the answers to these questions from a really interesting, journey through the physics of and the dynamics of creation and their feedback effect. It became clear very early in my childhood that there must be some kind of feedback between the external world and the internal world of a being, because we experience the world outside of ourselves and interpret it, and then the world outside of itself seems to respond to that, meaning that if I see a glass on the table full of water and I reach out to grab it, right, my hand, when it gets there, grabs the glass, and thus the universe is responding to my internal, observation of the glass in the first place. And so for me, it was clear that there must be some feedback, and it was clear that the universe could not self-organize in such complex ways. You know, in one human being, there's enough DNA to wrap the world 5 million times, it's serious amount of information, it's serious amount of organization, and it was clear to me that there must be some learning system, the universe must be learning in order to keep self-organizing in more and more complex ways and have systems that are highly efficient, you know, like 100 trillion cells in one human body all collaborating so that, you know, you don't start growing a nose on your toe and a toe on your nose, which could be quite uncomfortable. And, you know, all this must be some huge feedback effect. Well, it became clear to me as well that, and this is what we were talking about just before the break, that the concept of a finite space and the concept of an infinite space could be reconciled by a feedback, an open feedback system, which describes fractal, which is a geometric structure described by fractal.
Very briefly now, for those who have heard the word fractals,
mm-hmm.
This is something that's relatively a new concept in mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
Within the last 20 years, this is a mathematical formula that shows through math a self-replicating system. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, you know, the Koch curve was found almost a little longer than that, almost 60 years ago, and so on. And, you know, and then there was the Mandelbrot set that was, you know, that mathematically started to plot fractals and so on, and then there was extrapolations from there. But the fractal concepts are very, very ancient. They can be found in most ancient civilization. You know, there's a famous physicist that went to South America and was asking a shaman lady down there, you know, what do you think is holding the earth in space, you know? And the shaman person said, don't you know it's on the back of a turtle? And, you know, the physicist thought about it for a minute and thought, well, you know, what's holding the turtle? And she looked at him and started laughing, and she goes, don't you know it's turtles all the way down? You know, and basically, you know, that concept of fractal structures, infinite repetition, infinite iteration of the same dynamics from infinitely big to infinitely small, is nothing new to the human race.
True, it's turtles, which looks like a Mandelbrot system when it's realized.
Yeah.
It's also a sacred animal to the Hawaiians as one of their amakuas, which they believe created the earth.
That's right. It's found that the turtle is very commonly, you know, described in many ancient civilizations as the creator or the supporter of all knowledge and all this. And when you look at the back of a turtle shell, you find the vector equilibrium, the isotropic vector metric, all the dynamics of the structure of the fractal structure of space that I describe in my series.
13 moons.
Yeah. Well, and so there's all sorts of, you know, dynamics that that are found, you know, in ancient civilization, all sorts of information that's found in ancient civilization that makes one believe that they had some grip on the concept that there was some kind of fractalization. I'll give you one of the prime examples I like to give about the fact that the universe is fractal, and this one is commonly overlooked. We all came out, we all emerge out of another person. You know, and people don't, like, realize this. This is kind of crazy thing, but we all emerge from another person,
right.
And we all emerge from our mothers. And, you know, that is, you know, when you look at generations, you know, you take those old pictures and you see generations of mother, your grandmother, your grand-grandmothers, and all this stuff, and you see the fractal branches of creation at work, you know, and so, you know, and then when you look in nature, the branches of a tree, the nervous system of your body, the veins of your body, the blades of grass, and so on, you can see fractals everywhere. So the proof of the pudding is that if nature has fractals everywhere, most likely fractals are fundamental to the way creation occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And that means that there's some kind of feedback in space. And that's where the geometry of the spin and the double torus come in, where the torus is the topological membrane in which you could have a feedback effect between the collapsing central part of the donut, you know, for people that don't know what a torus is, it's a donut, right? And the outside, which is, you know, the edges of the donut, which is, you know, if you put a dot on the edge of the donut and you rotate the donut gently, you will see that the dot rotates towards the middle and then back out to the edge. And that's the feedback effect, an open feedback that space and time, I believe, is imbued in, imbued of, and that it's the fundamental dynamics that generates consciousness, meaning that consciousness is a result of a feedback effect in space-time, or the feedback effect is a direct result of consciousness, whichever way you want to put it. But the fractal structures afford you the capacity to think in terms of infinities, infinite amount of information in a feedback, right, in the context of a finite system. Because in a fractal, you can take any boundary in the fractal and then find infinite amount of information within that boundary. For instance, in simple term, you could like make a circle, make an equilateral triangle and put it in it, right? Mm-hmm. And then polarize that. Now you got a Star of David inside a circle. And then you can put a triangle on each corner and you get smaller Stars of David. And then again, another triangle on those corners. You get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And you can do that to infinity, but you will never exceed the first boundary you've made for yourself, that first circle or that first sphere, if you'd like. And so within the context of a finite space, you have defined infinity, infinity towards singularity. Mm-hmm. So now the universe starts to look completely different. The universe starts to look like different scales of the same dynamics. You know, universal scale, galactic scale, solar scale, you know, planetary scale, biological scale, you know, atomic scale, subatomic particles, and so on. So we actually wrote a scaling law based on this. And the scaling law showed that, you know, we can plot the radius of an object, the radius of a system, like a solar system or, you know, a galaxy or, you know, a universe, and against its fundamental frequency of, you know, which is its energy level, right?
And how would one obtain the fundamental frequency of, say, our solar system?
Well, you know, we didn't use the solar system, but we used the sun, for instance. So that's a measurable, you know, frequency. And then we used the center of galaxies, which is a measurable frequency as well. And then we use quasars, which are measurable, okay, and so on. And then we have an idea of the irradiation pattern of the atom and the subatomic particles. So we use the data that's already available, mm-hmm, and their radius. And when we plotted the data points on a graph, then, you know, frequency against radius, all the data points lined up in a perfect scale of growth, linear scale, from subatomic particle right up to universes, all the data points describing various scale of the same dynamics, you know, that is, various scales of black holes, describing the whole universe as different scale black holes. And really, really amazingly, really like unfortunate, I mean, like we couldn't have expected this, although instinctively I felt that way, and we discussed this before. We found that the lipoprotein on the surface of a cell oscillates at 10 to the 11 hertz, which is an extreme amount of energy. And we plotted that oscillation on the graph against the radius of the cell, and it happened that the cell bisect the graph exactly in the middle between the solar and atomic structure. So we are, the biological resolution is like the event horizon between the infinitely large and infinitely small. We are that point of transfer of information between the very large and the very small.
In other words, we are the radius of our own system.
That's right. And so we, you know, based on this, it's very exciting to find this. It's not, it wouldn't be predicted in conventional physics that that would happen. But it's telling us many, many things, including the fact that we are living inside a black hole.
Now, this one, we better slow down on this one. Now, you're describing a black hole. We all think of the big sucking kind of thing that pulls all the light, everything, the gravity that's so dense.
Yeah.
Is the black hole itself like a tube torus of energy? It's pulling and roiling like a big donut in its center?
That's right. And, you know, this is the new view that we're bringing with this modified Einstein field equation, and we're showing that the black hole actually radiates a lot of energy because it generates, because of the torsion field that is being generated in space-time, meaning that the black hole is not stop still in space. It's rotating at very high rate of rotation, and because it rotates, it radiates a lot of energy. And so, in fact, now we're starting to see the black hole in a completely different way. We're starting to see the black hole as a black hole at the center with a white hole around it, you see, instead of seeing the white hole and the black hole as two different objects in two different universes, we're starting to see them as inside each other, the black hole in the middle and the white hole on the outside. What we see is the white hole part. We see the outside of the event horizon radiating energy, like a star, you know, a galaxy, an atom, a subatomic particle. We see these things because they radiate energy. However, the radiation side is because of the collapsing nature of space-time in the middle, according to this view. And so then you start to see the universe in a feedback between the radiative side, the electromagnetic field, and the gravitational field. And that's where the torus comes in. Absolutely right. You start to see a donut type of shape because there's a feedback of radiation and collapsing and radiation and collapsing. So, for instance, I'll give you an example. My theory 15 years ago predicted we were going to find black holes at the center of all galaxies. I was in big trouble for saying that in many physics conferences. However, now we have discovered that all galaxies that have been closely observed have black holes at their center, and most astronomers agree that most likely all black galaxies have black holes at their center. However, if the galaxy we're in has an immense black hole, which we have measured now, thousands and thousands, actually millions and millions larger than our sun, how come if these things all swallow everything that's around them, how come we are radiating away from it in our galactic disk? Well, that's because that black hole is spinning at a rate that's sufficient to overcome the gravitational collapse and still move objects away from it in a very specific manner. However, as the spin slows down, as you get further and further from the center black hole, then the gravitational field starts to overcome the object again, and the object starts to move back towards the central black hole, describing a huge elliptical course that it goes up the halo of the galaxy and back the north pole or the south pole, depending on which side of the galaxy the object was.
So to make the donuts.
That's right, to make the donuts. And I don't know if people can visualize that out there, but it looks like two vortices touching into the middle of the black hole at the center of the galaxy with a big galactic disk which radiates material out, which is the billions of stars that is in our galaxy. And then these stars move up into the halo, which is a perfect sphere around the galaxy, and then eventually back down to the disk. And we know that star follow that pattern. We have mapped it out. What's different in what I'm saying is that now we can explain why that is happening and what are these dynamics. And those dynamics are Coriolis type of dynamics, Coriolis type of dynamics that are secondary effects from torsion in space-time itself.
So I know that you're working with the observatory here on the Big Island. We have one of the most, perhaps the most advanced telescopes on planet Earth right here, looking up, and you're hoping to be able to demonstrate some of these things with the astronomical phenomenon that we can observe through the telescope.
Exactly, and to answer your question better, you know, the fact is that when we look at the universe with our larger telescopes, the universe has an excess amount of mass for the escape velocity of light. That means that the universe itself is a black hole. There's more mass in the universe that's necessary. There's more density in the universe that's necessary to make it a black hole. That means light cannot escape our universe. You can imagine, for instance, that a beam of light that shot through our universe is being curved by the gravitational fields of objects. That's what Einstein, you know, discovered. Now imagine that there's not just one object, like in the universe, there's billions. And that light is being curved by every gravitational field of these objects. Eventually, that light curves right back onto itself. And so that's our scaling law shows that we're living inside a black hole, and that's why the vacuum inside the black hole looks black. However, all the objects inside that vacuum are smaller black holes that we are on the outside of. And those look white because they are radiating, because we're seeing their outside nature. From the outside of the event horizon, they look like stars, galaxies, you know, planets, atoms, subatomic particles, and so on. And right down to the subatomic, you know, Planck's distance, which is the smallest, you know, singularity size, you know, object. And that means that every atom we're looking at is a mini white hole, black hole. White part being the radiative side and the black hole part being its internal dynamics. And so that means that everything you're made of, it has infinite nature, has an infinite potential. And really, when you look at the universe, you can't really make a statement against that, because you know for a fact that atoms keep on spinning. They've been spinning for billions of years, and they haven't slowed down any. They spin at near the speed of light, and they continue to spin long after, you know, you're put under the ground. All we observe really in nature is not life and death. All we observe is cycles, changes. You know, the atoms of a human being are arranged in a very specific way, and then they organize in a completely different way, and we think that the being is not there anymore. Although all the information and all the spins are still occurring. They're just occurring at a different level, at a different resolution of organization.
So life goes on. Energy is never destroyed. It's only transmuted from one form to another.
That's right. Spin continues to infinity. And that tells us we live in a universe of infinite energy, of infinite potential. And that has a huge impact on our technology, the way we think of technology, and the way we think of propulsion, the way we visualize, you know, the universe, and eventually even the way we visualize life and death.
Well, these are exciting concepts, and I think we're on the precipice in opening up into a new level of consciousness for humanity. There seems to be evidence that we've reached this threshold before by what the ancients have left as their signs, their symbols that were in their monuments, the way that they built their symbols, the yin and yang, the I Ching, the pyramids, the Mayan calendar. All of these seem to indicate that this point of awareness was reached at some point in our past. So perhaps we're coming full circle as a tube torus, back, being drawn back to a point of origin. And our own life cycles as a species, as a culture, as a society, is reflecting in much the same way as what we're seeing, the evidence of spin on a universal and a subatomic level.
Yeah, you can actually see the feedback process and the learning of universal forces either through history or even through the history of biology, the evolution of complexities and systems and so on. I mean, it's everywhere, it's prominent, and it's in our face. And it is not currently well understood or mapped in current physics. And I think that the key is really the bringing of the spin components and the torsion components to the way space-time interacts with matter. And, you know, that sounds a little technical, but it actually is, you know, much more intuitive than it sounds. You know, just like I said, just like water goes down the drain, you can imagine that, you know, information flows into you as you radiate energy. You know, as you eat throughout the day and you do your chores and all this stuff, you radiate energy into the field. And as you do, you pick up senses. You know, you absorb electromagnetic light from your eyes, you know, the little black dot, you know, the little black opening in your eye that allows information to move into your brain. And the nervous system picks up information and your smell and all this stuff. And so you are gathering information as you're dispensing energy. And that feedback, right, generates our reality, generates, you know, the way we interact with the universe and the way the universe responds to us. So, you know, you start to see how that become, how that understanding could have a huge impact, for instance, on the responsibility that people have to their environment and to the universe and to each other. And, you know, because when we realize that it is a feedback effect, then we know that whatever we put in the field will feedback, and, you know, we might want to put things that are more positive so that we get a more positive feedback than one in which we're engaged right now, which seems to go towards destruction and alienation of humankind.
You know? Separation versus unity. And this really is the whole purpose of why the work has generated so much excitement amongst yourselves and the people who follow your theories. I think it's great that we are on this threshold of being able to, say, prove conclusively that we are not separate at all, that we are connected to each other, to the things around us. Every living system is interconnected. And I think that's marvelous, because the dolphins and whales have been giving us evidence of that for as long as I've been swimming with them.
That's right. And, you know, it seems that nature in general understand these principles. Actually, you know, nature went through a moment of very high, you know, a moment of a very high discordance before it agreed to collaborate. The biological system, the microbes, you know, used to, you know, compete. And when they did, they produced a lot of oxygen, which was poison to them at the time. And the poison, the pollution was oxygen at the time. And they were having a heck of a time dealing with it. And it went to the point where it was menacing the destruction of all microbes. And it wasn't until microbes and monocellular systems start to collaborate, they reached this moment of intensity where they were all going to be destroyed, and then they started to collaborate, and they generated more complex system, multicellular system that eventually were able to breathe the oxygen, right, and live off it. And that's how really evolution went to a whole new level. And really, we as fractal levels of that evolution are now the larger microbes, you know, learning collaboration and unity. And when we do, I believe we are going to move to a whole new level of interacting and existence.
Our evolutionary track is allowing us to move to our next level of being. Mm-hmm. Well, we're at the top of the hour. This is fascinating. I hope that you're going to hang with us. If any questions come to your mind, you can address them online to broadcast@dolphinville.com. And if we do have time towards the end of the program, we'll see if we can have Nassim address some of those. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about how this consciousness affects us, how it might be applied to technology, and some of the other fascinating things that we've gotten involved in as a result of this new wave of thinking. But first, let's listen to a little of the Andrew Forrest Starseed album, specifically Merkaba Resonance. Seems appropriate at this stage. We'll be back shortly. Thank you. Okay, we're back with Nassim Harriman. I just want to remind everybody that you're listening to Dolphinville.com Radio. This is a radio-free enterprise, something that's going out to the Internet globally. And we set these up so that if you're listening live, terrific. I hope you're enjoying the show because there's a lot of energy coming out of this room. I've seen a levitation over across the room from Nassim a couple of times. But I'm intentionally putting this out as an archive as well so that you can go back, listen to it, tell your friends about it. It's going to be available as members of Dolphinville.com community. It is free. You can sign up. Go to the membership, sign in. Just simply put your name. You can make up your own password naturally and put whatever information you want. If you have a website, and certainly other people who have become members of Dolphinville can communicate with you. It's about connecting people with these kind of common ideas. What has brought Nassim to the show is that he's here living on the Big Island of Hawaii. He's swimming almost on a daily basis with dolphins and whales. He's part of the ocean, and the ocean liquid consciousness that we're all sharing here is affecting the way he is. It's helping him perhaps deal with this very, very intense new theory of reality, theory of everything, and liquefy his consciousness to be able to accommodate with the path of least resistance to get to these new levels.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really interesting that, you know, our modification to Einstein field equation implies hydrodynamic, you know, models, because if torsion is involved, you're talking about the same dynamics as liquids would have, you know, and so on. So, you know, it's very parallel to my experience with the dolphins in the morning where spinner dolphins fly by me spinning, you know, 10 feet up in the air and, like, demonstrating torsion fields right in front of my eyes.
Well, we talked about the dolphins blowing bubble rings. Now, for anyone who's seen this phenomenon, dolphins and whales have been doing this for at least 10 years. They can blow out of their blowhole a perfect, what looks like a smoke ring, but it's a bubble ring in the water. That is a tube torus.
That's right.
It's an amazing kind of demonstration.
That's right. And it's very appealing to think that they're giving us, you know, hints about the dynamics of space, the dynamics of topology in space, and that they're giving us ideas that we should look at, you know. I mean, when they do this, they usually do it, you know, while, you know, in either, you know, in captivity with researchers looking at them, or, you know, doing it when, you know, there is boats, you know, around the whales looking at, you know, the whales. And really, you know, what are they trying to communicate? Well, one thing is for sure is that the torus is fundamental and that it's important and we should look at it. And
bubble technology. You know, I think the curious thing, too, in the context that they've given it to us, they're saying, here's something to look at, but here's something to take lightly. We're having fun with this. We're mm-hmm. playing with these tube torus energy systems, mm-hmm. and we're going through the middle of them. We're bending them in space with our sonar capabilities. We're showing you a way of playing with the capabilities of the universe rather than taking yourself so seriously, mm-hmm. so solidly. Mm-hmm. Let's liquefy our thinking. Mm-hmm. I wrote a paper that was submitted and is online now at planetarylightworker.com, which the title of the paper was Spirit as Water. And I use the analogy that the water of the planet and the water of our bodies could well be the physical representation of spirit in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can look at the analogies all the way down to the molecular level.
Yes.
What is spirit? And what would be a way of representing spirit? Something that's all around us, something that's malleable, mm-hmm. something that we depend on. It carries essence of life force within it.
Mm-hmm.
So water and spirit may be part of the same dynamic that we're looking at here as far as consciousness model.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that all living things, you know, emerge from water, and, you know, and that, you know, the water molecule is a tetrahedron molecule, and, you know, there's a lot to say about that. There's a lot to say about the codonic systems that DNA uses to generate the double helix, which is a torsion field, you know, and so on. And the water that is found in the angstrom size, you know, packet of DNA at the center of the cell, water that is highly structured and so on. And so, you know, there is a direct relationship there between the water molecule, the way the water interacts with the thermodynamics effect, for instance, the fact that water expands when it's cooled and contracts when it's hot, you know, is contrary to all other materials and so on. That is, you know, it is very possible that water is really kind of the doorway molecule from which, you know, the information of space-time curl moves in to generate living systems. And, you know, some of these evidence is the fact that we're standing here today, you know, having emerged from water, you know, individually from the water of our mothers or globally from the water that was on this planet when the life emerged.
Well, our planetary system, we know, is comprised mostly of water.
Mm-hmm.
Our bodies are comprised mostly of water. In fact, I don't know if the details are exact, but the proportions are very similar to the amount of water in our bodies and the amount of water on the planet ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we are little planetoids spinning in our tube torus energy fields.
That's right.
We are reflecting a larger system, a planetary conscious system, which is reflecting a still larger system, a solar system, which is reflecting a still larger system, fractionally until the largest that we can see and then beyond,
mm-hmm.
systems upon systems.
That's right. And then, you know, from a local perspective, from one frame of reference, we might feel isolated, or we might feel, you know, separated from the rest of the universe. But when you pull back from the rug again and you start to see the fractalization, you start to get a perspective of the unification of all things and how the separation is only as a result of taking a certain frame of reference. And by changing that frame of reference, all of a sudden the perception of separation goes away. And, you know, I think that, like, in one way, the water dynamics that we see in space, or the water dynamics that we see on the planet or in our body, which, you know, it's interesting as well that the percentage of water in our body is similar to the percentage of water in quartz crystals, for instance, and so on. So, like, you know, the crust of the Earth has much of the same, you know, water percentage to mineral percentage and all this. So basically, when you start to look at it from those perspectives, you start to see a thread, a continuity, a continuum from infinitely big to infinitely small, in which we stand at the event horizon, at the center of the curvature, if you'd like, and observing both sides. And, you know, that view eventually leads to a being becoming totally integrated with its environment, totally integrated its society, its way of doing things, its way of generating technology, and all this is integrated with the dynamics of creation. Now, you know, all this is nice philosophy. And as far as I'm concerned, because I'm a, you know, experimenter and inventor as well, it has very little meaning if it's not applicable to technology. It really does. Because you might be thinking of singularity and all this good stuff. If you're running out of oxygen because you're using cars, and, you know, you're running out of, you know, potable water because you've got nuclear power plants everywhere and all this, that all becomes a big problem. So if you have to be able to address and apply those higher thoughts to technology, and I think that is absolutely valid and possible. And actually, you know, any engineer out there that understands that space-time has torsion in it can probably pretty rapidly figure out a way to tap into the space-time torsion, to tap into the causes of torsion, the cause of rotation that spins the atom to infinity, you know. And the result of being able to do that would have a huge impact on all of our civilization. Our technology would change dramatically, very quickly. a large amount of energy, I mean infinite amount of energy, would become available. Space travel and propulsion would become completely different than what we're doing now, which is basically sticking, you know, tons of fuels on
top of two sticks together.
Yeah, exactly, and lighting up the bottom and praying that everybody survives.
Blowing it up there.
Yeah, we could mm-hmm. start to, you know, use space-time itself as a propulsion system.
We were talking before the break about how the earlier systems, the amoebic systems, had to find a way to coordinate their activities or else they would extinguish themselves. It seems like consciousness itself has come full circle. We are now in a very similar way. There's always been kind of like opposing views of technology versus organic.
Mm-hmm.
And there always seem to be, well, if it's technology, then it's mechanistic and it has this kind of system that it works by. But if it's organic, it's natural. And there always seem to be a conflict in many of the minds of the New Age communities or people who are expanding their awarenesses.
Mm-hmm.
And yet now we're seeing evidence. Such as the movie Matrix, for example, was a good example of how, even in its own Hollywood way,
mm-hmm.
of showing that these two systems, the technology system and the organic system, are now moving towards a unity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is maybe our key to our survival.
Yeah, I was really keen on the movie Matrix because of the message. You know, the basic message that was being conveyed throughout the movie, throughout the three, you know, sequence, is the battle of the spirit and its dealings with technology, and how we perceive technology, you know, and the dichotomy that comes from thinking that technology is what's destroying us instead of realizing that it's the way we are perceiving the universe that generates a technology that's destructive, you see? Because if you start to see the unity, if you start to see the fundamental forces of nature as they are, then the technology that emerged from it is a very positive, very life-giving technology which allows self-sustaining systems and that supports, you know, infinite amount of energy, infinite amount of space, you know, because you're able to travel across the galaxy, you're able to see other, you know, civilization around the universe and so on. So the, you know, I think that this is a very big step for humanity. It is the step that is the most crucial. It is so difficult to walk the path I walk because I'm standing right between the two on that tension line, you know, on in the middle path, you know, with the physicists on one side saying we don't need no stinking consciousness and with the conscious people on the other side saying we don't need no stinking technology and trying to reconcile the two and showing both sides that technology and consciousness are a feedback from each other and that we, you know, that as we rise in consciousness, it is crucial, I mean, crucial that we apply these higher thoughts to physics and eventually technology so that we develop a technology that is self-sustaining and that matches our level of consciousness. And that level of technology is on its way. And, folks, it will blow your mind because it really is a complete opposite set of concepts that is going on around right now. A set of concepts that says that there is infinite amount of energy, that there is infinite amount of abundance, that there is plenty for everybody, and that it's okay to collaborate and support each other and rise to the occasion and become part of a larger community that is the galactic community that I believe has been around the planet for a long time supporting our evolution and waiting for us to reach this level.
Well, I think we're seeing evidence from the dolphins and whales as perhaps the best example of an alien intelligence that we can look at, deal with. They, in a playful way, are asking us to look at simple examples of coexistence. They're looking, they're showing us ways of existing within what is called unconditional love as a means to be able to have relationships. as we're speeding towards this new enlightened state. We've all heard the buzzwords, the paradigm shift, and we were all waiting with bated breath as we went through the magic triple zeros, thinking that, okay, the line is crossed now. We're going to be going into a new phase of our awareness, a new phase that perhaps we could destroy ourselves entirely. And much the same way as you were talking about a system that reached its critical point where it would either destroy itself or it would find a way to be cooperative. For me, I saw the binary system as we've existed and demonstrated that we have this on one side and this on one side, and it was ping-ponging back and forth, much the same way our brains function. But another tier of thinking has come into it, what I call playfully the trinary system, one which the two of them are coexisting to create a third point of reference. And that third point of reference, I believe, is our salvation.
That's right. And, you know, that third point of reference really is like the standing wave of the two first one, and it has a synergetic effect, meaning that the result is more than the parts of the system. And so as a result of the synergy of consciousness and technology coming together, you get a whole amazing development of consciousness and advanced knowledge, that really takes a whole new evolution. You know, it takes us to a whole new level of comprehension of the universe and how we deal with things. I mean, it's as big as discovering that the Earth is not flat and that it's round. You know, all of a sudden consciousness, you know, can visualize more accurately the dynamics of the Earth, and then we start to be able to travel around the Earth. And as we start to be able to travel around the Earth, we realize that the Earth is not so big. You know, it starts getting smaller and smaller, and we start to realize that it's not so different, that we're all human beings and all this. And so really, you know, as we expand in our capacity to visit the universe and understand its dynamics, we expand in our capacity to have a sense of wholeness and a sense of belonging in nature. And that's really what we're going through right now. I think we're going through a new tier of that awareness coming into our... I like to think of it that way as an example. We are all standing on a sphere, and our heads are diverging because we're on the sphere, right? If you took a vector through the center of your body and pointing outwards, our heads would all be diverging if we were all standing up, right? Mm-hmm. However, our feet are all converging to the same center, linking us all through the gravitational field of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And that's the higher fractal entity that is gathering all the information we're gathering on the surface. And then that Earth is gravitationally attracted and tied to the gravitational field of the Sun, which is connected to the center of the galaxy and so on. And that's the path of the information transfer through
the feedback loop.
The feedback loop, exactly.
The torus that brings it back to the beginning.
To the beginning, mm-hmm. To the individual, to the singularity, to the whole learning about itself. So, like, we're all individual probes learning the universe from our own perspective, because nobody else is able to stand in our shoes and see this glass of water the same way that anybody else sees it. So we're all picking up information from our own perspective and feeding it to the whole, right? And then the whole feeds us back experiences, which we feed our interpretation to the whole again, and so on. So we're all participating in the whole view of the universe. And when we see that, then we can reconcile with each other.
Well, I believe it's a Sufi saying that's so often used, as above, so below, which is another way of describing this very system that continually feeds itself.
That's right. And that has, you know, and it continually feeds itself, but not in a closed loop, but in an open feedback in which it's constantly learning and growing and evolving. And that we see everywhere in nature. We see the evolution of a system from even, you know, people don't realize when we think of like a monocellular system that was on the Earth that complexified into, you know, all the biology we see. Well, in fact, every being that comes to be goes through that evolution, because we all started with one cell and got into more complex cells and all this stuff, and then eventually made a human body. So we actually all go through that evolution individually, and you know, that is like the fundamental evidence that, you know, that the universe is evolving, is changing, and that we're part of that change, that we're part of that evolution, that we are some of the, you know, at the front of the fractal, at the very edge of the fractal. The fractals look back at itself and learns about itself. And so
maybe that's exactly the event horizon that we're facing.
Mm-hmm.
And as so many of us sense on one level, and other people have more hard evidence, that perhaps there's a greater galactic community who are watching quite patiently and with a great deal of interest as we, as a species, are going through this evolutionary step. It could be that we've reached this evolutionary step as a species in the past, and because of some other physical conditions, maybe the Mayans were able to step off planet through some kind of a dimensional doorway that was being offered by some of the galactic fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to believe that, from my optimistic standpoint anyway, I think that we haven't been brought this far so that we can incinerate ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But I still believe that that possibility has to exist in order for us to make the choice not incinerate ourselves.
Yes.
And by making that choice, thereby we graduate to the next level of our evolutionary consciousness.
Exactly. We need that to be able to make, to have the lesson that we need to have. You know, we need to be pushed to the extreme before, you know, we can, you know, take an appropriate decision, having seen all of the consequences of our acts, you know. And that really is where the world stands at this time. And really, it's really an amazing time to be alive, an amazing time in history. And, you know, and I'm confident, like you said, that we will take the appropriate decision, whatever that is, for our evolution, and that there is higher civilization, galactic civilization, that have been observing us for a long time. In fact, my research shows, and I've done quite a bit of research in archaeology and anthropology, my research showed that there's evidence that the human gene, the Homo sapien, was actually a splicing that occurred on this planet, that the missing link that in anthropological theories, where the Homo sapien kind of shows up out of nowhere and, you know, overcomes all the other larger, you know, species, comes from the splicing that occurred between the higher evolutions of our galactic disk and the Earth. And this is actually mentioned in over 500 different cultures around the world in various ways, you know. From Genesis in the Bible to the Mayan codices to the Inca codices to the Egyptian texts and so on, all describing an intervention that occurred in the evolution of the biology of the planet that generated the human consciousness.
We're a star seed, and the planet Earth is actually a petri dish for this experiment in human dynamic.
Well, yeah, and imagine that you were an advanced civilization that was able to go around the galaxy. Now, the galaxy has about 300 billion stars. You know, that is a lot of people to go and visit. And, you know, if you were to find a planet like ours, and that planet was not very evolved. I mean, people were living in caves, you know, dragging their women by the hair and all this stuff. You might, you know, think, well, you know, you couldn't just go in there and, you know, try to, you know, bring them high level of technology or high level of understanding. I mean, it would be just too far beyond their understanding. It would be like landing an helicopter in the middle of, unknown African, you know, tribe. They'd freak out, run away, throw lances, whatever. So basically, you know, you might, if you were an advanced civilization, what you might do is you might implant, you know, a set of information, a set of genes that would speed up and bring the evolution to a whole, you know, to a new level, to help, you know, bring. Now, why would you do that? Well, you, if you understood, if you're a civilization that understand the fractal nature of the universe, you know that more there is little worlds out there learning about themselves and learning about the universe, more information is available for everybody. So more people rise, faster they rise, more civilization evolve, more the Galactic Federation evolves. You know, it's good for everybody. And so you probably would start little worlds around and help them evolve and support them and as well protect them from themselves during difficult times. And I think we were protected from ourselves a bunch of times.
I have to agree. There's probably evidence that they've stepped in on more than one occasion. And I've had some intuitions that were given to me through my contacts with Swimming with the Whales. And they told me of some stories. We'll cover that when we come back after this short break. I think this is all leading to the point in case that we are ready to step into another level of our evolution. There are intelligent species who have a wealth of information to share with us, but the key is that they cannot share with us until we are ready to accept ourselves as who we really are. Now, that's the major choice that we are faced with right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, and collaborate in a way that we become a non-violent species and be approachable.
Right. So we're not separate, we're together. And so with that, Michael Hammer will bring us through some tunes here, and we'll be back in a few to wrap this up and maybe get to any questions that you might be sending to broadcast@dolphinville.com. We'll be back in a few. Back home now. This is Dolphinville. This is part of a network which I like to call the Dolphin Matrix. I created a website a couple of years ago called dolphinmatrix.com. I wrote a poem at that time called The Dolphin Matrix. Matrix coming inspired by the first movie back in 1999. It goes something like this. We create this sphere of luminosity linked by filaments of light, connecting consciousness as an energy field, like gravity or the atmosphere of this planet. All manner of things contribute to this web of information that spins its fractal patterns into an echoing assemblage of infinitesimal meanings. We create the matrix and bend our minds around there is no spoon, but here on this side, on this other side, where liquid atmospheres form altered states, there is no gravity. No limits or restraints to hold us back. Hold us back from experiencing the pure joy that is. Welcome to the real world. Let's dive right in.
Fantastic. That's beautiful. Thank you.
Well, I'm here, and I'm having a great time. We have been going up one side and down the other. There was one listener who asked the question, since we're talking about galactic federations, have you personally, Nassim, had any encounters that you would say with the ETs?
I talk freely about these things because I had direct experience. And, you know, from direct experience, just like Elizabeth was describing last week, you know.
The ghost
story. Elizabeth is a mainstream physicist that, you know, is very grounded in the physics community and so on, you know. For her to say, well, I actually saw a ghost, and since then I believe in ghosts, is quite, you know, the statement. But it's the fact that when you experience something directly, then it would be very difficult for you to deny it from that moment on. And so for me, you know, early in my childhood and then later on, I had many experiences with direct contact with advanced civilization that were not from the Earth. And it became clear to me very quickly that there was, you know, an overseeing eye out there that has been, you know, going around the world and, you know, protecting us from ourselves and as well, you know, fostering evolution with things like crop circles, you know, that are, you know, very specific geometric structure, most of them fractals, you know, describing, trying to bring us to the understanding of the fundamental structure of the universe and how it works and how we can apply it to technology. I really feel that crop circles are part of what they do to help us, you know, get higher level of resolution in our consciousness.
I call it sacred art, and it does really form the perfect definition of what sacred art was intended. When you see the windows of a church, for example, or Celtic symbols that were used, all of the classic religions, if you will, or higher thoughts have used art that is anonymous in nature, but yet reflects things like the phi ratio, which is what the Greeks dealt with, and there it is right in front of our face, a growth principle that can be reflected back. Why does it feel so good? Because there's something in it, inherent in its design.
Yeah, and as well, I find that it's so sad that everybody has to have a direct experience in order to, you know, in general, in order to be convinced. And, you know, because if you dive into that material of, you know, UFOs and encounters and all this, there is so much material out there from, you know, at this point, millions and millions of witnesses that have had very similar experiences, that have seen the same thing, in some cases with thousands of people being witnesses. You know, these things are not easily discounted as hoaxes and so on. I mean, if it was a few, it would be one thing, but when you're talking millions of people, and, you know, if you're looking in various countries, you'll find that actually it's not all the countries that have the same attitude of the, you know, the U.S. or the Canada or other Western world countries. Some of the countries are very, you know, straightforward and clear about this. One of them is Mexico. You know, UFO activity in Mexico has been going through the roof, literally, since a solar eclipse that occurred in 1990. And the, you know, the activity there has been so overwhelming that the government had to make public statements about it, and they very much so, you know, admitted to the presence of these crafts and has implemented training for pilots that fly commonly into Mexico City so that they can avoid the UFO highly trafficked routes and so on. So, you know, in other countries it's much more, you know, accepted, and, you know, one may ask, well, why is it occurring in Mexico and not on this side of the border and so on? Well, it might have to be with the amount of aggression that, you know, is on, you know, in other countries. You know, Mexico doesn't have a very highly efficient military, you know, infrastructure with, you know, F-18s, you know, chasing things around all the time. So, you know, in that context, it's much easier for these higher civilization to interact with the public in these other countries where it's much more difficult in countries that are highly guarded.
Well, everywhere there are signs, and yet the signs are then turned around, such as the movie signs, which was a travesty to anybody who has studied crop circles, used as a mere prop to foster a different kind of story, and that it was, you know, a thin connection to what crop circles might really represent as doorways or entryways for other dimensional beings.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, the aliens in that movie were portrayed as the classic scary guys that you had to slaughter with a baseball bat.
Yeah, and that really brings us to a subject that's close to my heart, and that is that the propaganda about the fear that's being generated about advanced civilization being in contact with human beings is so prevalent, even in the advanced spiritual communities, where actually the New Age and many spiritual communities are the first to promote the fear and, you know, the bad grays and all this stuff, which is, you know, really only, I believe, very subjective. It's not, you know, well researched. It's not coming from direct experiences and so on. And I would really guard people about buying into this, because really, when you are a spiritual being and you're buying into the fear of meeting with advanced civilization, you're really supporting exactly what you're trying to get away from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there is no evidence. Absolutely no evidence that there is any aggression from any advanced civilization on this planet. And I can say that with confidence, having met a bunch of them and knowing where they're coming from. And, you know, I guarantee you that even in simple logic, you can come to that conclusion, because if you have an advanced civilization that made it to this planet thousands of light years away from their home, they have the technology that they could, like, take over this planet within an instant if they wanted to. And they haven't done that. There's no evidence that they would do that. And there's much more evidence that they have been protecting us and supporting us through our evolution, if anything else.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that I don't believe that a destructive civilization, a civilization that is in a feedback loop of destruction, make it very far. I don't think those civilizations survive very far. Look at ours. We barely made it to the moon. We're still struggling in landing probes on Mars. And we're just about at the point of extinction of our own lives and the life of all things on Earth. And so, you know, going out of our solar system is not even, you know, a possibility at this point, and certainly not with the attitude that we have towards the universe and how it works.
Sure.
So I'm saying that I don't believe that advanced civilization that could make it down here would have that type of intention. And if they did, we wouldn't be here talking about it.
Yeah, they could have taken us over right away.
That's right. And so, you know, really going, because really what's going on is that we're applying our own aggressivity and our own concepts of war to other civilization, just like if you would say that a whale, you know, is the whales are trying to take over the planet. I mean, it's the same thing. And so, you know, what we need to do is sink into our hearts and feel the support and the love that the universe and that all beings in the universe have for each other. Feel the connectivity of all these things. And when we do that, we really open up to the possibility of being in presence of those beings, because they will be able to approach you without you freaking out, grabbing a gun and trying to shoot at them or anything else. But if you're in complete fear, there's not many volunteers out there that are going to go, oh, let's go and see Joe there, you know, because, you know, Joe owns, you know, a bunch of guns, and most likely he's going to shoot. So, you know, it really has to do with our capacity to deal with our own internal fears and our own, you know, internal, you know, discontinuity, you know, in our thinking about the universe, you know, in the way we relate to the universe. I don't think they see themselves as extraterrestrial. I don't think they think of themselves that way. I don't think they see themselves that way. I think they see themselves as actually the forefathers of our civilization, and that they see the unity in all things, and that they don't see any extra to their terrestrial, you know, presence.
Sure. Well, it's a total birthing process. And getting back to the same model, this beautiful tube torus model, where everything is coming back to itself. So the beginning of the creation, if it was star-seeded, as some have supposed, that our very species on this planet was given birth so that we might be able to reach a level of consciousness where we could understand we are self-replicating, we are part of an infinite system, we are connected, and unity really means love, so that it is not about separation, it is not about fear. But it is separating that polar thinking to the extent where we can go beyond our own fears, our own polarity. And fear, really, I think, is the impetus of all polarity.
That's right. It really, you know, that doesn't alienate the concept of polarity. It doesn't mean the universe has not a polarity. It just means that, you know, all polarities are unified in singularity, meaning that, you know, that the difference between a man and a woman generates a concept of separation and polarity. However, the two are necessary to generate life, a new singularity, to generate a new event horizon, a new level of existence. And it is only in the context of that unity that we can evolve to a new level. And really, you know, seeing these advanced civilizations as part of us and part of our evolution and part of our galaxy, and you know, letting go of flags, you know, letting go of concepts of, you know, well, this is our Earth, you know, and this is our galaxy,
this is my land,
and seeing that it's all, you know, belongs to everyone with respect for everyone. You know, you don't overstep your boundaries and go on somebody's land if they don't want you there, and so on. But that we are all unified in this amazing ship we call the universe, in this amazing spaceship flying through space, you know, learning about itself. When we see this, then everything inside of us goes to rest, and we feel that singularity, we feel that stillness that allows us to be in the presence of what I believe are very much advanced beings that have been monitoring us for many years.
Well, it seems you talked a little bit earlier about the technology being a tool that could liberate us from a lot of the problems that we've experienced as part of our universal problems here, the polarity thinking. One of the questions that came from one of the listeners addressed if you knew of any technologies that you could address or theories of technologies that could be applied towards making this planet a livable space and getting rid of the pollutions and getting rid of the things that are seriously jeopardizing us and putting us in a state of fear.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that some of these technologies have been built for a very long time. I mean, Tesla was one of them that build technologies that could be very, very much an advantage to the, you know, to the way we're doing things.
And direct current versus alternating current.
Well, yeah, that was definitely, actually the other way around, alternated current versus direct current. But, you know, definitely, you know, what Tesla came up with in many, many instances, in many of his patents, are technologies that could really, you know, make a big change in the way we do things that would have a very positive impact on our environment. However, these technologies have not been developed. Many inventors tried to develop them and to bring them to bear, but they were, you know, in many cases suppressed and so on, because, you know, changes, again, it comes back to fear, you know, changes bring fears and the tendencies to resist these changes. I am aware of many technologies that could have a huge impact, and I think that the technology that come, but ultimately I think that the technology that comes out of the theory that we're discussing right now, the theory that I've been writing and Elizabeth and I are just about to publish, is a technology that brings humanity really to a full understanding of at least the dynamics that are going on in our local universe, and allows us to really kind of hook the technology on the fundamental will works of nature, so that the technology operates in complete harmony with nature and extract energy from nature and recycles the energy back to nature by using it. And, you know, when that comes to bear, then a civilization really moves to a new level of being in the world. And so I think many of these technologies that, you know, were built by, you know, Tesla and then eventually, you know, others, were really precursor to this fuller understanding. And the way I'm going at it is really going through the physics so that there is a foundation for these concepts. You see, if you have the technology and it's working, but there's no foundation for the concepts, then there's no place in the current physics and scientific community to place that technology in. There is no basis for it. There's no theories for it. There's no mathematics for it. So it just doesn't get in. But if there is a very high level of accuracy in a theory which predicts the possibility of these devices, then all of a sudden it becomes acceptable and it becomes clear that there is a pathway to arrive to these devices, that it is possible, that it is not inconceivable that, for instance, a device would have, you know, a perpetual type of motion for thousands of years. You know, it becomes clear that the atom itself is a perpetual type of device that goes on for billions of years, right? So that
was a good invention.
Yeah, and nature is doing a really good job at showing perpetual motion, and that if we understand those simple principles of nature, then we can reproduce those principles in technology to create that type of, you know, perpetual type of motion and perpetual amount of energy.
Well, we see as we've gone through these primitive stages, and much like Stanley Kubrick's 2001, when consciousness first was born in awareness, the first thing that was created was a weapon. And likewise, when the atomic structure was starting to be understood and the enormous amount of energy produced by splicing one single atom, mm-hmm. the first thing we did was to turn it into a weapon of mass destruction.
Correct. And so your point being that maybe this is going to bring us to the same level of destruction. I have, you know, that was a very, very specific, significant ethical consideration I had very early in my research. I mean, after, you know, having found many of the things I found, you know, I realized that technology could be, you know, extrapolated from it and so on, and the power of that type of technology, I right away, you know, had an ethical problem. That is, do I really want to give that to what I'm seeing out there, you know, to the civilization we're in and how they interact with each other, and what are they going to want to do with this? Well, you know, the result is that one night I had a huge bonfire going and I had all my research there and I was just going to burn it all out and I was going to live the rest of my life in some cave somewhere and forget about the world. It became clear as the night went on that I wasn't going to be able to do that, that what I had been given If it's correct, it was is extremely significant, and you know that I needed to, bring that to the world, and that I couldn't really, take that decision for the world itself, that I had to be consequent to my own teachings and allow the world to fill up its own feedback loop. Now, I actually came to understand and believe that this level of technology cannot be misused. And that is because the misuse of technology that's going on right now is possible because the feedback between our action and the reactions of our action is very drawn out. It is very delayed. It takes a long time. Now we're starting to see, for instance, the result of all the nuclear testing, of all the nuclear, power plants and all this polluting our environment and biting us back, in the butt. That is the feedback loop at work. We're seeing the result in nature everywhere where, there's problems. Now, in this new level of technology, the feedback is almost instantaneous, because you're reaching much closer level of resolution to the original fractal structure of space. You're reaching the source of all energy. And when you reach that, when you reach close to singularity in your technology, then your technology responds in its feedback almost instantaneously. And thus, if you have destructive behavior or a destructive, intent, it's more likely that the technology will not allow to survive that intent very long before you have time to make much damage to anybody else.
Well, I like that theory. I think it's very accurate. I know a lot of the seminars I've been involved with here, when we take people around and remind them just where they are on planet Gaia here, this is a very, very intense energy spot witnessed by the volcano and the so-called Pele energies. We do remind people, be careful what you ask for here, because you will get it instantaneously.
That's right. I think that feedback loop is getting shorter by the minute anyway, without even the technology, because we're tuning in and we're getting more and more clear and more, tuned in to the torsion field of space-time. And our intent is manifesting faster and faster and with stronger results. And so it's very... now that is very exciting and it has much potential, and at the same time it comes in with a very high responsibility that, you got to watch what you think and you got to watch how you think about things, because it will come back and bite you in the butt.
Well, as we're drawing near to the end of this show, it's been fascinating. And let me just put this out to you. We're embroiled with a number of systems on the planet right now, political systems, religious systems, philosophic systems that seem to have created the conditions that we're facing. We're looking now for alternatives. Part of our discussion here is being able to demonstrate that there is a system that exists, a universal, unified system. All we have to do is begin to employ that and accept it as part of our beings. That could very well change. Do you see that there would be some seminal event, perhaps, that would turn people's heads away from these antiquated systems that are no longer functioning? And if you do, what would that event be?
Well, I think it's a combination of a bunch of things. I think that there is events that are occurring right now in our solar system and on our planet that are natural events that, will lead people into looking deeper on, what is important, and are going to help people see how, for instance, people think in cases of tragedy and cataclysms that people are going to do like a Mad Max movie, get all apart and start fighting against each other. But actually we see that like cataclysms or difficult times have a tendency to bring people together. People open their heart to each other. They support each other. They help each other. And it changes their consciousness. And so I think there is some of these events, some that have occurred already and some that are to occur, that will help humanity really starts to hold together and starts to see their commonality instead of their differences, and support each other. So that's one thing. I think that as well, as we move towards, you know, that event horizon that is coming, I think that we're seeing more and more what we don't want. Because, you know, the separation and the war concepts and all this are becoming culminating to a really high level of heat now that is making everybody aware of where the direction that this society has taken is leading us. Mm-hmm. And people are starting to want to take different actions, different decisions and all this. So socially, I think we're reaching a point where people are able to make a clearer line between what they don't want and what they want. And so that's one thing that's changing the field as well. And I think the galaxy itself, that our position in the galaxy and our position in the realm of the dynamics of the galaxy is changing, physically changing, and that we're entering a place in which there's a higher level of coherency, and that's demanding that change in our spirit, in our psyche, and in our body. And our bodies are changing as a result. Our DNA and the information that's available to us is changing.
Well, this has been all too fast. We've gone through 2 hours of time, and I think we're just starting to get into something now. I hope you'll come back as a neighbor and share some more of this fascinating information where we can talk about it.
Yeah, it would be my pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, Nassim Haramein has got some theories that are affecting us all. He perhaps has a new model of existence that will be viable proof that we are unified, part of the same system, and we can relax and know that we're no longer separated, which is what the masters have been telling us all along. I appreciate everybody who's been here listening today. I hope that you'll return again and again and listen to more of these programs. Nassim has been very generous with his time and his information. Randy Barris and Photon.net have been the most generous with their time and information, giving us this broadband width of Internet information. Photon.net is an Internet service provider, and they will give you dial-up services all over the country. Right now, they're expanding out into broadcast capabilities, and if you missed it earlier on, that the Global Sacred Geometric Conference in Sedona, Arizona is going to be broadcast live over photon.net. And I appreciate everybody who's listening today. I hope you'll come back for more shows. Tune in to dolphinville.com and have a good life while you're doing it. Smile a lot. Remember, be well and swim free is what the dolphins shared with me. And I will see you next time around. It's the Dolphinist signing off. See you.